Father God, we do thank you so much for this time together. Thank you for the people that went before us, that finished well, that did all that they could to glorify and honor you. Help us to learn from them, to be encouraged by them, to realize that as bad as we think our day is, they had battles in their time too. Help us to take courage and realize that you are the one that equips us all in just the right time. Thank you, and we pray and ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so tonight is going to be a difficult one. I think I've said that before, but because there's absolutely so much in the life of Adoniram Judson and his wives, that it's very hard to narrow it down. And Kathy keeps reminding me, because I'd walk through the house a dozen times saying, "I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know how I'm going to do this." And she would say, "Just tell them it's an introduction. You can't do it all. You can't cover it all." So, okay, thank you. Half hour later, I'd walk through. "I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know how I'm going to do this." She said, "It's just an introduction. Think of it as cliff notes." Okay. So anyway, I'm hopeful that it's going to be edifying. I'm hopeful that you'll get the sense of who these people were and how they followed the Lord. They are very dear to me. Anybody, I think, who's read much about them realizes they were special in a number of ways. But in the same way, in the same sense, they were plain. They were just regular people. It's an interesting thing when you talk about heroes and you realize almost every hero throughout history is just this regular person, male or female, that does what God calls them to do by faith in their time. And really, that's what makes a hero. So let's keep that in mind as we go forth. It's an introduction. I'm going to show you the books that I have, and refer you to one in particular that I'm going to recommend highly that every one of you that I can see here reads. Okay, first off, this is it. A big, thick, black book called To the Golden Shore. To the Golden Shore. And it's by Courtney Anderson. And it's the life of Adoniram Judson. And you remember when we did Jonathan Edwards and I told you that Ian Murray's biography was of him was my favorite. This is my second favorite. It's almost tied for first. It's told so very well. It's researched so well that you will, if you read this book, well, once you start, I believe you won't be able to put it down. But if you read it, you're going to know Judson and his times like you can't imagine. It's just brought to life. The next is the memoir of Mrs. Anne H. Judson. Now, interestingly, it's from her point of view that most of the biographies of Adoniram Judson are taken because, and I'm going to read you a statement in a minute from the original biography, because she kept her diary and some letters. And so that's where a lot of this came from. And that's what this is, primarily her life and letters. Then there's the lives of the three Mrs. Judsons, because there were three. And it's hard to imagine, but we're only going to talk about the first one, Anne. This was written in 1851. This one was written in 1829. And To the Golden Shore was written in 1956. So these are kind of source material for To the Golden Shore. But then we also have, oh gosh, The History of the Baptists. And this is truly an old book. This was written in 1850. This is an original 1850 edition. So it's the history of the Baptists up through 1855, excuse me, that's when it was written. Adoniram Judson died in 1850, so he is in here, but he's almost on the last page. But this is part of the source material too. All right, then finally, well, not finally, a book called Christian Baptism, and it's written by Adoniram Judson, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it later on. Then there's the Memoirs of the Life of Adoniram Judson, and this was written in 1853, 3 years after he died. So this is the primary source. All these others are sources as well for this book, To the Golden Shore. All right, so that's where we're getting all of our material. Now, here's the quote I want you to think about. This is from the fella, Dr. Francis Wayland, who wrote the original biography. He says, from peculiar views of duty, Dr. Judson had caused to be destroyed all his early letters written to his family, together with all his papers of a personal character. Mrs. Ann H. Judson, whom from here forward I'm going to call her Nancy because that's what everybody called her, even though her name was Ann, from prudential reasons during their captivity in Ava, destroyed all his letters in her possession. Manuscripts were also consumed by the burning of Mr. Stevens' house in Moulmein. Dr. Judson's correspondence with Dr. Staunton perished by the shipwreck of a vessel. And last of all, his letters to his missionary brothers in Burma were lost by the foundering of the ship, which was conveying them to America. So all of this material has been lost forever, but we still have a good, good resource in Nancy's letters and other information as well. So he goes on to say, my materials, therefore, consisted chiefly of his official correspondence, much of which had been published in missionary periodicals. His opinions on many subjects can never be recovered, but the record of his deeds is beyond the reach of both fire and flood. So that's just to tell you there was so much more at one time out there. We're operating off of a small amount. But when you hear about his life, you think, oh my goodness, how could there be even more? So it's really astounding what this man and his wives were able to accomplish for the Lord. Okay. I have big red letters written here on my paper. Remind them that this is just an introduction. So that's what I'm doing. This is just an introduction. All right. Adoniram Judson was born in 1788, and his father, like Jonathan Edwards' father, was a congregational minister. Unlike Jonathan Edwards, though, Adoniram Judson's father was, according to what we know, he was very austere and stern and he believed that things were only right one way, biblically, to the point that he received several offers to be a pastor at various churches, but unless it was a 100% call, he declined. Because he said, I don't want even one person in this congregation not in line with what I believe. So that made his early ministry fairly difficult. So that gives you an idea about him. Well, Adoniram was, again, a precocious child. He was reading the Bible chapters by the age of 3. I mean, Wow. He was solving math puzzles from newspapers at the age of 8. Okay. So this is kind of this extraordinary person that I was talking about. But at the same time, he's an ordinary little kid that's trying to figure out, how do I please my parents? How do I do all this? And so part of that was, okay, I'm going to obey. I'm going to go to church. I'm going to do all these things that they say are important to them. He had an aptitude for languages as well. So he went to college at the age of 16. So remember, we've talked about Calvin at 14, Edwards at 12. Well, he went at 16 and graduated at 19, number one in his class. And this was what now is Brown University. That's where he went. But while he was there, and parents, it's even worse now. His quote, faith and belief in God was destroyed by his closest friend. And I say this to parents because, you know, parents, you raise your kids, they get ready to go to school, and you are praying, Lord, watch over them. Keep them, don't let them go fall in with the wrong people. Well, Adoniram fell in with the wrong people. Best friend Jacob Eames was a deist. Now, you remember we've talked in the previous lectures about deism and how it was coming over from France. So deism, just to refresh your memory, is a belief that maybe there's a God. But if he is, all he is a creator. You know, he doesn't interact. He kind of made all this, but he's gone. That's deism. It's really naked and bare. It's kind of this philosophy that says, well, it's invented because people don't want to have to deal with their conscience. And so theism says, yeah, there's a God and he's involved in the world. And Christianity says, yeah, there's a God. He's involved in the world. You've sinned. You got a problem with him. His son is the only answer. So Christianity kind of is this funnel down, as we've always said, to the one way. Well, so this friend of his, Jacob Eames, says, no, that's so passe. You got to get with the new thinking. The deism. Now, I will tell you that at this point, just before this in Adoniram's life, his family had lived in Braintree, Massachusetts. Does that ring a bell to anybody? That's where John Adams lived, who was at that time president of the United States. John Adams and a lot of those people, founders, were deists as well. Now, I hate to burst everybody's bubble, but they were not actually, according to their writings, according to what we can discern, they were deists. So it was this whole philosophy that was engulfing the intellectual circles, deism only. So his faith was basically destroyed. He came out of there wanting fame. He wanted to be a literary scholar, or he wanted to go into law and politics. But he had no use for Christianity. So when he graduated, he had to hide this from his parents, which he did. He felt like a hypocrite. He just would do prayers at night, but he just felt like a total hypocrite. Finally, he said, right, get ready for this. Finally, he said, Mom and Dad, I want to go see the world. And so guess where he went? New York City. And his mom thinks, oh my goodness, that's the worst place on the planet. He didn't really tell them why he was going. The reason he was going is he wanted to go on stage and he wanted to be an actor and live with actors and write for the theater. So they're just beside themselves, but they realize they can't hold him there. So he leaves. He's 20 years old. He wanted to see the world, but he also, right before he left, had this giant blow up with his father, where he told his father, "I don't believe any of this." And his father is stunned. Here's his son that he's raised. He's been in church all his life. He's gone to a great school. He does prayers with us. He is absolutely stunned. His mother and his sisters are weeping and crying, and he just basically leaves. So he went to New York, and he traveled with some actors and just got disgusted with it because they were just wretches, and they would go to a town, and they would stay in a hotel, and they would sneak off and not pay for their rent for the night. He said it was just a terrible time, and this went on for several months. Finally, he's disillusioned with them, and he says, "I don't know where I'm going to go." He rides to his uncle's house. Now, his uncle is a pastor as well, but as long as it wasn't his dad who was breathing down his neck, he kind of felt okay about it. Well, his uncle didn't happen to be there, but this young pastor was there, and they talked. And so the young pastor and Adoniram are about the same age, and Adoniram later says, "I couldn't understand it. This man had no giant ambitions, but yet he was peaceful. He had in his grasp all that he wanted and was content with it." And so that kind of rankled on Adoniram. He said, "What is up with that? This guy needs some ambition." Well, he saw the solemn but gentle earnestness on this man who would never be famous, he said. "This man's never going to be famous." So as he leaves the next morning, he's on horseback. He's really not sure where he's wanting to go. He's headed west, and his family lives east, so he's just kind of letting the horse ramble. So he ends up at this inn, a hotel of the day. But as you can imagine, they're very sparse furnishings there. The innkeeper says, "Yeah, you can stay here. We've only got one room that's available, and in it there's a person that's dying. So I hope that won't keep you awake all night." And so he says, "Okay, I don't care." So he goes to bed. He through the night he's hearing gasping and moaning and coughing, and all these sounds of a person in the throes of death. And so finally in the morning, as he's checking out, he said, "What happened to the person in the room next to me?" And the innkeeper says, "He's dead." And Adoniram says, "Well, you know, that was just kind of this blow to him, a final sound that was unexpected. But he began to think, am I ready for death? And his conscience kind of became awakened. And as he was settling up his bill, he said, "Well, do you know who this person was?" And the innkeeper says, "Oh yeah, he's a young man from the college. His name was Jacob Eames," which is the deist who had destroyed Adoniram's faith. And Adoniram just is dumbstruck at God's providence at bringing him out of nowhere to this one inn to witness the death of what was his best friend in college, who had totally destroyed his faith. So he wasn't sure what to do. He was in turmoil, internal turmoil. So what could he do? He went back home and thrilled his mom. His dad didn't know what to do with him. They had already argued. They had nothing left to do. Two pastors, friends of his dad, came to meet his dad, not for the purpose of talking with Adoniram, but as they were there, they were talking with him. And they said to his dad later, they said, "This man is under conviction, but from what we can tell, the Lord is really trying to work and to use him. We recommend that he go to the brand new seminary that they were opened, so that they had just opened, so that he can have time to answer his questions, get his soul straight." So he did. He went to the seminary finally. Now, part of his figuring it out was reading a book by Thomas Boston called Human Nature and Its Fourfold State. This, for him, was a book that he really needed to hear because it went all the way from creation through the fall, through redemption, and all the way to glory. And part of his problem had been, I don't see the need for God in anything other than creation. So this was a big help to him. So he goes there to Andover Theological Seminary, was the name of it. He was able to discuss his doubts with the professors there. There were two of them. And he said in November, quote, he began to entertain a hope of having received the regenerating influences of the Holy Spirit. Now, he was, at that point, he was aware of his need. He knew the solution. He was reaching out. He was not sure he was saved at that point. On December 2nd, he finally made a solemn dedication of himself to God. So this was not a blinding flash of light like Calvin had. It was a slow and steady understanding, awakening, reaching, resting on the Lord. And he found rest for his soul. So from that point forward, he was a new man. And he says he banished forever those dreams of being a famous writer or a politician. And he said, and he simply asked himself from that point forward, quote, how shall I so order my future as best to please God? So that's this young man now who is a believer, still ambitious though, if you think about it. When the Lord saves you, he doesn't say, okay, everything that was David goes away, it's now somebody else. No, it's still me. I've still got my same strengths, weaknesses. The Lord's just going to use them, whereas before I wanted to keep them for myself. So he's still got the same, he's still got ambition, and he wants to serve the Lord. So he, while he was still at the seminary, he kind of became engrossed with the Kingdom of Burma through reading a British author who had been there at one point. And the British author was talking about the Burmese and how they were kind and open and all of this. So he kind of got enthralled with that. And he began thinking, could the Lord use me in Burma? And I'm going to quote what he says. It was during a solitary walk in the wood behind the college while meditating and praying on the subject and feeling half inclined to give it up, that the command of Christ, quote, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, was presented to my mind with such clearness and power that I came to a full decision, and though great difficulties appeared in my way, I resolved to obey the command at all events. So he had resolved that he was going to be a missionary. He had his eye on Burma, but he knew even if it wasn't Burma, at that point he wanted to be a missionary. He didn't get a lot of encouragement at the seminary, believe it or not. The students didn't think much of it. Even some of the professors didn't. But it happened that very soon after that, there was a council of ministers from the churches, and he spoke with two of them. And he spoke to also two other students who did share his beliefs and his desire and his drive and wanting to go to be missionaries. So they spoke to the ministers. The minister says, okay, we'll bring this up at our association meeting. So they did. And it was approved, but nobody had any money. There was not an association. There was nothing. I mean, England had the London Missionary Society. They were spending 10,000 pounds a year supporting Kerry and others. America at that point had nobody. And so these congregational ministers said, yeah, we think you are good men. You have a great desire. It's an honorable objective. We want you to sit tight and let us figure out how to do this. So, you know, that sounds great, but Adoniram is very ambitious and he wants to move forward. So he says, well, can we make a formal presentation? Well, they made the formal presentation, and each one of the men was back, it was up to four by this time, gave their own reasons for wanting to go. And the committee and then the full association says, yes, we will do this. Let us figure out. Now, the reason I'm dwelling on that is something else happened right there, right between the time he first spoke to them in the morning and then when they did their four of them doing their testimony in the evening. He had had lunch at one of the deacons' houses and met Anne Hasseltine, whom he fell in love with immediately. I mean, remember Wilberforce, the 10-day courting before he got married? Okay, so here you have Adoniram. He meets her, he falls in love immediately. Within 30 days, he is proposing. And let me give you a little bit about her background. She was a very carefree young lady with no deep religious thoughts until she read Pilgrim's Progress. I am plugging all these books for you guys. Oh, and by the way, I forgot to tell you this. While he was at Andover, the seminary, still, while he's making this proposal, his best friend there, unlike Jacob Eames, that tried to destroy his faith, his best friend there was a man named Gardiner Spring. Remember this book from our very first time, The Distinguishing Traits of Christian Character? I said, there's some traits that all people have and there's some that only Christians have. Guess who wrote this? Gardiner Spring, his best friend at Andover. So I'm tying this all together for you. Anyway, so Anne, or Nancy as all of her friends called her, was reading Pilgrim's Progress and she realized, this doesn't sound like me. These people are serious about their faith. What's with me? So she goes through all this turmoil and eventually realizes she had rejected God because she didn't want a sovereign God to rule over her. Her eyes were open. She submitted. She became a believer at 16. So it's at the age of 21 that Adoniram meets her and declared within 1 month after meeting her that he wanted to be her suitor. Now, she wonders in her journal, so she's been a believer for 5 years now, but she wonders in her journal, in her diary, can I, and I'm going to quote this, can I submit myself entirely to God to be disposed of according to his pleasure? And she decided, quote, yes, I feel willing to be placed in this situation in which I can do most good, though it were to carry the gospel to the distant, benighted heathen. So Adoniram had broke his heart open to her. This is what I want to do. And she's saying, could I do this? I mean, I've lived all my life here. I was a frivolous young lady. I've been a believer for 5 years. Could I actually do this? Well, she believed she could, and she told him, well, I'm going to read you what Adoniram did next. He wrote a letter to her father. Oh, my goodness. Get ready. He said, I have now, this is to her father, I have now to ask whether you can consent to part with your daughter early next spring to see her no more in this world, whether you can consent to her departure and her subjection to the hardships and suffering of a missionary life, whether you can consent to her exposure to the dangers of the ocean, to the fatal influence of the southern climate of India, to every kind of want and distress, to degradation, insult, persecution, and perhaps a violent death. Can you consent to all this for the sake of him who left his heavenly home and died for her and for you? For the sake of perishing immortal souls? For the sake of Zion and the glory of God? Can you consent to all this in hope of soon meeting your daughter in the world of glory with the crown of righteousness, brightened with the acclamations of praise which shall redound to her Savior from heathens, saved through her means from eternal woe and despair? Wow. So he was 23 at the time, and I'm telling you, that's a cheeky 23-year-old in my book, but a serious Christian man talking serious to his loved one's father, talking the real stuff. So they, her parents left it up to her. If she wanted to go, she was free to go. Well, she said yes, but they ended up being parted for a year because the association sent out an IRM to London to say, hey, is there stuff we need to understand before we start this? It took him a year to get back. He ended up in a French jail for a while. This story is so unbelievable. We're not even to the amazing part yet. So they finally get back. There are several other missionaries that are going to go on the boat with them. On the voyage, they're all sick, as you can imagine, never having sailed. Adoniram, who had been translating the New Testament while he was in seminary, keeps going with it, and all of a sudden starts saying, I think the Baptists may have this right. And Nancy says, what? And he says, baptism. She said, oh, leave it alone. And he said, but if I truly believe this, how can I baptize infants? How can I do it by sprinkling? And she said, well, just don't worry about it. And she says, quote, this is a letter she wrote home, I tried to have him give it up and rest satisfied in his old sentiments, and frequently told him, if he became a Baptist, I would not. He, however, said he felt it his duty to examine closely a subject on which he felt so many doubts, and determined to read carefully and prayerfully the whole fast or embrace the truth, however mortifying and however great the sacrifice. She began exploring it also and came to the exact same conclusion. Now, what this means is they have been supported and sent by the Congregationalists. Their co-missionaries on the boat are Congregationalists. One other man, Luther Rice, ends up meeting with them, and he had the same conviction. He changed from a Congregationalist to a Baptist, but that's later on. So this is what Nancy wrote home. Thus, we are confirmed Baptists, not because we wanted to be, but because truth compelled us to be. We have endeavored to count the cost and to be prepared for the many severe trials resulting from the change of sentiment. We anticipate the loss of reputation and of the affection and esteem of many of our American friends. But the most trying circumstance attending this change, and that which has caused us most pain, is the separation which must take place between us and our dear missionary associates. We feel that we are alone in the world with no real friend but each other. No one on whom we can depend but God. So they land in Calcutta, and Adoniram talks to William Carey, who who is a Baptist. And William Carey understands and ends up writing a letter back to several Baptists in America saying, the Lord has providentially placed this man at your service. Please support him. 3 weeks later, the fella who was on station with William Carey, his name is William Ward, I think. Yes, baptized Adoniram and Nancy. And 3 weeks after that, Adoniram preached the sermon that we had here, which William Carey says is the best sermon on baptism I have ever heard in my life. So all that's happening, and they haven't even got to the mission field. So what a life, what a whirlwind. Now, what happened, like I said, Luther Rice became a Baptist, but he had contracted some ill health on the way. He ended up going back to America to try to generate support for the Judsons. So he ended up playing a hold the ropes type of role for them that they wouldn't have had any other way. God's providence is amazing. So they were ordered out of Calcutta. Now remember, this is 1812. William Wilberforce didn't get Parliament to pass the change to the East India Company's charter until 1813. So at that point, East India Company is still anti-missionary, and they were basically hounded out. They went from island to island. They kept trying to come back and figure out where to go. They wanted to go to Burma, but were told, don't even think about it. Whatever you read, it's a terrible place to go. Well, they finally end up in Burma. On the way, however, Nancy has a miscarriage and the baby dies on board. So they get there, and for the first 3 years in Burma, they are basically the only Americans and Europeans. When they got there, Felix Carey, William Carey's son, had a small mission of sorts, but he really wasn't reaching out to the natives. And as soon as they got there and he saw that Adoniram was gifted and able to do this, he left. So they were basically starting a mission from scratch for 3 years, didn't see another American or European. Well, like I said, this is an introduction. I'm going to compress a whole lot of stuff here, so get ready. And if you don't get all your questions answered, there's a book I can recommend that you read. All right, so they had another child that died at 8 months old during that time. It was 4 years before they held their first semi-public worship service. It was 6 years before they had their very first convert. Now, all, like I said, I'm compressing it. There's so much drama in between them getting there and this first convert. It's beautiful. I am going to read the letter that this first convert wrote to Adoniram Judson. He said, I, Maung Nau, the constant recipient of your excellent favor, approach your feet. Whereas my lords three have come to the country of Burma, not for the purpose of trade, but to preach the religion of Jesus Christ, the Son of the Eternal God, I, having heard and understood, am with a joyful mind filled with love. I believe that the divine Son, Jesus Christ, suffered death in the place of men to atone for their sins. Like a heavy-laden man, I feel my sins are very many. The punishment of my sins I deserve to suffer. Since it is so, do you, sirs, consider that I, taking refuge in the merits of the Lord Jesus and receiving baptism in order to become his disciple, shall dwell with yourselves, a band of brothers, in the happiness of heaven and grant me the ordinance of baptism. It is through the grace of Christ that you, sirs, have come by ship from one country and continent to another, and that we have met together. I pray, my lords, that a suitable day may be appointed and that I may receive the ordinance of baptism. As it is only since I have met you, sirs, that I have known about the eternal God, I venture to pray that you will still unfold to me the religion of God, that my old disposition may be destroyed and my new disposition improved. Wow, what a testimony. That was their very first convert after 6 years. So it was 10 years until they had 18 converts. So this is a long time of intense labor. And what I can't probably communicate is how difficult life was, just life. With the death of their son, with trying to have food, with the sanitary conditions, with the constant interactions with those that were in authority. I mean, it was a, on a whim, somebody could be beheaded. On a whim, somebody could be thrown in prison. So that was going on all around them. Well, then war broke out between Burma and England. Burma had invaded Bengal, I think, and England was going to come retake it. So they got in war. Well, at that point, the king of Burma said, all Europeans are potential spies, throw them in jail. Well, it's not just jail, it's prison. And it's not just prison, it's death prison. They are shackled in irons. It was Adam Irem and about four other men shackled in irons, inside in the dark with no fresh air. At night, they would raise their ankles so that just their shoulders touched the ground. That was how they had to sleep. It was brutal. It was called the death prison. Now, all this time, Nancy, God bless her, is going from official to official to official. And these are sometimes miles and miles apart. She is the only female Westerner in that entire part of the country. And she is going to all these officials to plead for their release. I mean, the heat's 100 degrees. She has no protection from anybody. And oh, by the way, she's pregnant. So what she ends up doing when she gets no results from all of these men is she builds a little hut right outside the prison so she can go live there, so she can take Adoniram food each day and see him for just a little bit of time. She gets sick, Adoniram gets sick. Things get worse and worse and worse. He's there for 18 months. She is trying her best. I cannot communicate the drama, the sadness, all the stress that she must have gone through, all to just try to plead with them to release her husband, who's not a spy, who's not even British, is not part of the war. Well, it's to no avail. She has suffered heat fatigue and had a baby and is nursing the baby as she's doing all this. One of the people that she went to ask for help was a governor, and it's not the same as a governor here. He was not very high up, but he was high enough that he could have helped. He laughed at her. And as she was leaving, she had a little parasol, an umbrella, to try to protect herself from the heat. As she was leaving, he grabbed it away from her. And she said, I need that to protect myself from the sun. He said, you were too skinny. The sun can't find you. So by this time, she had lost so much weight. She was literally skin and bones, and this man was tormenting her. Well, by the time the war was concluded, neither Adoniram or Nancy were recognizable. They were skin and they were bones, and they were malnourished. They had really no energy. They had nothing left. All their belongings had been confiscated, except Nancy had saved Adoniram's manuscript of the Bible and wadded it up in a blanket that he used for his pillow, and that managed to be saved. So all through this time, they're just trying to exist. And so finally, they get to the end of the war. It couldn't be better, they think. 6 months later, Nancy dies. She had been worn out by all of that she had been trying to do. Adoniram had been able to see her for 6 months. He was actually not there when she died. When he heard about it, he came back, didn't see her grave for over a month after she died, saw the little baby that was still alive. 6 months later, the baby died. So I'm telling you these things to say that this man's work was not something where he just sat on a veranda and the natives were giving him a fan and helping him to keep the flies away. It was brutally, brutally hard on him and all the other members. I'm leaving out all the other people that came to help, many of whom died, many of whom children died, wives, husbands, all of that. So I'm giving you, this is an introduction, remember, I'm giving you the bare bones. So I'm going to really skip, because the letter that Adoniram wrote back to Nancy's mother is just too poignant. I can't read it. I'll weep. But this man was not an unfeeling man. He was devastated. But he ends up marrying the widow of another missionary, Sarah Boardman, who died in 1945. He then married, after he traveled back to the U.S. for health reasons and to try to promote the mission, he then married an actress by the name of Emily Chubbuck, who outlived him, actually. Then in 1850, at the age of 62, he caught a cold that settled in his lungs. He got dysentery and then a fever which would not leave him. Then the doctor recommended that he go on a voyage to one of the islands out in the Indian Ocean. That was their way of treating back then. You know, go on a voyage and you're going to feel better. The ocean air will do you good. Well, it didn't. He died on the voyage and was buried at sea. So his remains are unknown, like one of the people that said afterwards, just like Moses, whose remains are unknown as to the place, so with Adoniram Judson. So now let me give you a quick legacy of what his ministry had accomplished by the time he died, okay? By the time he died, he had written a grammar that is still used today. He had written a full translation of the Bible into Burmese. He had written he partially finished an English to Burmese dictionary. By the time he died, there were 100 churches in Burma. There were 8,000 converts by then. Now, not all of these were his. Other missionaries had come to join, had been in different parts of Burma, but he was kind of the godfather, if you'll pardon that phrase, of that mission to that country, and everybody depended on him. And because of that, what was called Burma and is now called Myanmar has the third largest number of Baptists worldwide today, behind the US and India. And his was the start. Now I'm going to give you a personal connection here. Way back, 27, 28 years ago almost, I was flying back from a business meeting, and I was, believe it or not, one of the few times I've preached in my life, Pastor Steve had asked me to preach, and so I was studying on the plane for a sermon, and this Asian fellow was sitting next to me, and he looked over, and he said, "Are you a pastor?" And I said, "Oh, no, I'm just a layman, but I am going to be delivering a sermon in a few weeks, and so I'm studying." He said, "I've never seen that book, and it was about the Apostle Peter." So I let him look at it. He said, "Oh, yeah, this is very good." And I said, "Where are you from?" He said, "I am from Burma or Myanmar." I said, "Really?" I said, "What do you do there?" He said, "I am the president of Faith Bible Baptist College and Seminary in Yangon, Myanmar." And I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No." I said, "Is that one that was planted by Adoniram Judson?" He said, "No, it's not one he planted, but he is the one we all look to as the father of Baptists in our country." And I said, I was blown away. I was trembling because I had just probably a year before read this book and was enthralled with it. And here is this man who was a native Burman who, and you can go look up on their website, he's got his testimony on there. He had started the college at the time that I met him 8 years before, but he was converted in 75. He was a dear, dear man. So I said, "Well, what are you doing in the States?" He says, "I'm raising support for our college." And I said, "Oh my goodness, well, let's correspond." I said, "Have you ever heard of the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well," so that kind of clued me in. I'm not sure who he's getting support from, but it's not confessional Baptist. So I said, "If you'll give me your address, I'll send it to you." So I did. And here's his reply. "Dear Brother Vincent, thank you so much for your letter and the book. I never came across this particular book before, and it is a real enlightening book to me as far as Baptist tradition is concerned." That was very satisfying to pass that on to Burma. Anyway, the rest is personal stuff about his kids. Praying, he said he'd pray for my travels and asked that I pray for the progress of their seminary. I'm happy to tell you that the seminary is doing great. If you see their website, they got pictures of their library, systematic theology, Calvin's Institutes, or I see them on the, I enlarge the pictures so I can look and see what books they're reading. I looked and looked and looked for the 1689, but I couldn't see it on the shelf. But I know that he had it. So with that personal note, what I want to do now is pick out one situation that happened right at the close of the war and see what you think about the character traits of Nancy Judson, not Adoniram. And I'm going to read to you from the book. Think about this. Think about what she has been through This is 7 months before she died. All right. The English commander was going to give a dinner, and it was going to be with the Burmans and the missionaries and the English soldiers. This was to celebrate the peace treaty that they had just agreed on. The dinner hour was announced by a regimental band in full regalia. Solemnly, the whole company assembled in couples, the Burmese commissioners following suit as well as they could, and marched to the long dinner table. General Campbell, in his dressiest full dress uniform, save for just such an occasion, walked alone in front of the rest. As he came opposite the Judsons' tent, which was next to his own, the music stopped and the procession halted. Wonderingly, the Burmese craned their necks to see what would happen next. The British and Adoniram, having some idea, kept their faces impassive. The general went into the tent. In a moment, he reappeared with Nancy on his arm. Her thin face, demure, but her eyes dancing with some of the mischief of the Nancy Hasseltine of old. Ceremoniously, he led her to the head of the table and seated her on his right hand. These Burmese officials knew Nancy very well. For a year and a half, she had abased herself before them. For the smallest favors, she had endured rebuffs and insults without a murmur of anger. Now, this victorious British lord and general, most likely a brother to the king, gave her the position of the highest honor. As they cringingly took their own seats, they looked with fearful eyes at the pair at the head of the table, the wife of the American missionary and the commanding general of the British army. If she cared to tell what she knew, and if she were anything like a Burmese, she would. Almost every one of them had something to fear, probably death, certainly torture for what they had done. Nancy knew what was in their minds. She was too human not to let a little of what she felt show in her eyes. General Campbell, suspecting it, had difficulty repressing a smile. "I fancy these gentlemen must be old acquaintances of yours," the general said as the food was placed among them. "Judging from their appearance, you must have treated them very badly." The Burmese did not know English, but they could tell he was talking about them. One of them in particular showed fear. As he tried to eat, the food slipped off the fork he held in his trembling hand. The man's behavior attracted General Campbell's attention. "What is the matter with the owner of the pointed beard over there?" the general went on. "He seems to be seized with a fit of fear." Nancy looked at him carefully, warm recognition in her expression. "I do not know," she said, "unless his memory may be too busy. He is an old acquaintance of mine. Probably he considers himself in danger now that he sees me under your protection." And she told the story of how Adoniram had been placed in five pairs of fetters and thrust into the inner prison, half dead from fever, and how it was to this man's house she had walked early one morning to see if he would help a little. It was this man who had kept her waiting in the hot sun until noon, who had heard her request, refused it with contempt. It was he who had seen her silk umbrella as she turned to leave and snatched it out of her hand. It was he who had laughed and said, "Only fat people need to fear sunstroke. The sun can't find a woman as thin as you." The English officers, ranked along one side of the table, found it difficult to keep a courteous silence as she told the story. But their looks at the shrinking official spoke even louder than their few indignant words. By a sort of intuition, he seemed to know what Nancy had said. his face writhed with fear, his hands shaking uncontrollably. He tried to wipe the perspiration that oozed from his deathly pale face. Nancy took pity on him. In Burmese, she reassured him softly, "You have nothing to fear." She told the general nothing was to be done to this man. So, what kind of character can do that to someone who had treated her so horribly, who had not helped her husband, who was right there under her fingertips, and she could have gotten revenge? What do you say about her character? I'm asking.